accession number 19914, reel 1.
Colonel Henderson, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Sumatra at a place called Tibing Tinggi.
Which year was this?
1929.
Which part of Sumatra is this?
That's in north central Sumatra, opposite Penang, the straits of, I think they're called the Straits of Malacca, between the Malay Peninsula and the island of Sumatra. And in those days, my father was a rubber planter with Harrison and Crossfields, and she and my mother lived in Sumatra, and both myself and my sister were born there.
How long of your early days did you spend in Sumatra?
Until I was 6.
What kind of a life was it in those days?
Well, I can only just remember it, of course. And we lived on a rubber estate, in an estate house, and we were in the fortunate position of having gardeners and servants and so on looking after us, and cooks in the old empire fashion.
And you came to England to have your education?
I did, yes.
Can you tell me about that, please?
Yes, I was. My parents came from Edinburgh, and I came back with my mother and my sister and returned to Edinburgh, where we had a house. And I was at school in Stirling at a place called Hurst Grange, which is a prep school, and then I went to Melville College in Edinburgh, where I carried out my secondary education. And that finished in 1948, and at that stage I went to Sandhurst.
Any memories from the Second World War? Did it affect you at all?
No, we were not greatly affected in Scotland. In 1940, I seem to remember there was a threat that the Fourth Bridge might be bombed by the Germans, and indeed they tried it. I was at this stage only 10 years old and can barely remember it in detail, but they missed the bridge, and that really was the only war we suffered from. In fact, it boils down to absolutely nothing. Glasgow, 35 miles away on the west coast of Scotland, of course, suffered enormously because of the shipyards on the Clyde.
So how did you come to be in the army?
My father had been in the army in the First World War. I had enjoyed greatly being in the school cadet force, and I just decided in 1948 that that's what I'd like to do. I had in fact passed into Edinburgh University, where at one point I thought I might go and read geography, but I decided against that and went into the army.
Can you tell me about your first steps, please?
Yes, I joined the army on the 18th of March 1948, and in those days you had to do 6 months in the ranks before going to Sandhurst. And I went to Sandhurst in August of that year, 1948, and joined what was known as Intake 4. That is, it was the fourth intake of Sandhurst after the end of the Second World War. And at Sandhurst, I was appointed to Burma Company, which was one of the four companies in Victory College. And there I spent the next very nearly 17 months at Sandhurst.
What did you think to the course at Sandhurst in those days? What did you think to the course?
The course? I thought the course was excellent. It consisted of the military side, of course, and also the tertiary education, ostensibly military history, and the sort of education you would get at a university, where you are taught to think and work out things on paper so that they actually work. So I found the education there excellent.
And after Sandhurst?
We were all commissioned in December of 1949, and immediately I was sent to Edinburgh, where the Royal Scots were, because the regiment to which I'd been commissioned, the King's Own Scottish Borderers, was in fact in Hong Kong at that time. We were sent to Edinburgh for 6 months so that we could carry out our courses, which were a small arms course at Hythe in Kent. And having done that, we were posted to the 1st Battalion in Hong Kong, and we got onto a troop ship in those days and trooped out to Hong Kong, arriving there in June 1950. The 1st Battalion of my regiment was stationed at a place called Tammy on the Kowloon side of Hong Kong, up near the Chinese frontier. And there my life started with my regiment. It was a tented camp and an eye-opener to a youngster like me.
In what way?
Well, it was very much a different country to the one that I had been used to, that is Scotland and England. And it was a hot country, and June is in the midst of the very hot season in Hong Kong, and it was just different. But immediately great fun, because Hong Kong offered everything to youngsters like me at that time. It was not only fun soldiering, we were there, of course, with an impossible task, which was to prevent the Chinese invading Hong Kong, or the Kowloon, beg your pardon, the new territories, and then into Hong Kong. And this would have been quite impossible because of the seaboard round Hong Kong. The Chinese, of course, could have outflanked any force in Hong Kong at any time.
So what kind of measures were the battalion taking in Hong Kong?
Well, the new territories of Hong Kong are a very hilly part of China. And every battalion out there, in those days there was a whole division of troops out there, had a certain sector to look after. And we went up day after day to prepare the positions as defense positions should the Chinese attack Hong Kong. As you know, they had managed to take it from the Japanese a few years before with the grace of ease, because Hong Kong cannot exist without water. And it has not got its own water. Water comes from China into Hong Kong. So the Chinese could have cut off the water supply into the colony very quickly, and it would have been extremely difficult to exist there. We built defense positions day in and day out. During the day, we occupied them from time to time. We endeavored to keep the myriad numbers of Chinese who tried to cross the border and come into Hong Kong at that time. And it was our task, along with the police, to try to prevent them from doing so. But there was a great social side to Hong Kong in those days. We had lots of rugby football, which I enjoyed playing, and we played that in Hong Kong and also in the new territories. And the social life was fun.
What kind of Chinese were attempting to penetrate into Hong Kong? Were they economic or political refugees?
I would say that mainly they were economic Chinese, because life in China in 1950 was pretty mundane, whereas they could see that life in Hong Kong, for those Chinese who managed to live there or get across the border and get into and live in Hong Kong, was very much superior. And they were trying to get in to trade and live in this very successful British colony. But there was a limit to the number of people who could come into the colony, and it was the army's task, assisted by the police, to prevent them getting in. And indeed, if you know Hong Kong or the new territories, there is a wire fence across a part of the land between China proper and the new territories. And the Chinese in China were adept at burrowing underneath this wire and getting into Hong Kong. And it was our task to catch them when they came over. And there were various patrols out on the ground, and they could tell when people were trying to get through into the colony, and then one was stood to, and out we went to try to catch them. And we were often successful, but we were often, I'm sure, unsuccessful, and that is how the population of Hong Kong slowly but surely increased over the years, because I'm sure a great number of Chinese from China managed to get into the colony illegally and set up in business and so on. They're a great business race, as you know.
Were the people you caught single people or in groups?
They came in groups. They were mainly men. There was the odd woman amongst them, and sometimes trying to bring children, but mainly men, who no doubt hoped to become established in Hong Kong and then perhaps later bring their families over to join them.
And what did these defensive positions consist of that you talked about?
Oh, we dug trenches, we cleared fields of fire, we put down masses of wire. Now, all these things which we did between June of 1950 and April of 1951, which is part of the story I will come to in a moment, was turned out to be extremely good training for us, because all the things we learnt to do in Hong Kong, we were, unknown to us in June 1950, about to repeat because of the Korean War, which started in, I think, either June or July of 1950. And we had our first whiff of the fact that this might well affect us when the war started in that month in 1950, June or July, I can't just remember which it was. And two battalions in our division in Hong Kong were very quickly moved up to Korea. That is the Argyle and Sutherland Highlanders and the Middlesex Regiment, both of whom, of course, we knew well. And they went up to Korea and did a stint there. And then in April, early April, we as a battalion were warned that we were to go to Korea and relieve the Argyles. And that happened.
How did you feel about it when you heard that you were going?
I think we felt all right. It was an adventure. We had no idea what Korea was like. And as soldiers, we just had to get on with it.
What preparations did you... What was your job with the battalion at that time?
I was a platoon commander, commanding a platoon of about 30 soldiers in D Company of the 1st Battalion, KOSB, my regiment. And as I think I've said, we were warned in early April that we were going. We had a fortnight's time to prepare for the move, which was long enough to get ourselves ready. And I seem to remember that the date was the 18th of April when we moved down to Kowloon Harbour, Hong Kong Harbour, and boarded a ship called the SS Montrose, which was an American troop ship, and it carried our battalion and also the 1st Battalion, the King Shropshire Light Infantry, up to Ord's Korea. The trip took 5 days, and we were soon anchored off a city on the west coast of Korea called Incheon. And we arrived at Incheon on the 23rd of April 1951, which was the same date as the Chinese offensive, and they crossed the River Imjin. You may recall that the United Nations force had driven the Korean army from the Pusan bridgehead right the way north to the Yalu River between Korea and China. And then, of course, the commander of the United States forces, the United Nations forces, General MacArthur, made a threat of some form of nuclear attack upon China and was sacked by MacArthur, who was president of the United States. And very shortly,
Truman, I think.
Truman, I beg your pardon. Truman. And very shortly after that, the Chinese army attacked south across the Yalu River into the North Korean peninsula and made great advances very quickly and reached the United Nations line, which at that time was just north of the Yalu River, and they crossed the Yalu River on the 23rd of April 1951, at the same time as we arrived at Incheon.
Across the Imjin?
The Imjin River, correct.
So you're off the coast of Incheon?
In the SS Montrose. We could not take The SS Montrose alongside, because the harbour at Incheon had been destroyed, the piers and the harbour itself. And so we had to get off the SS Montrose and move back and forwards in small boats to the land at Incheon. And there we were met by RASC transport, including the writer of the career book, my old friend Michael Hickey, who was commanding a group of the RASC transport. And we then, without our heavy weapons, were rushed in the dark from Incheon into or towards the front just south of the Imjin River. And we did that with our personal weapons, a few rounds of ammunition, and very few maps, because very few maps of Korea existed at that time. And off we went into the dark. And the war started for us very quickly. We were due to relieve the Argyles, but of course the Argyles had been caught as part of the Chinese advance, and they were fighting a withdrawal action along with all the other United Nations troops, and taking over from them was not at all easy. And eventually, on about the 25th or 26th of April, we met in a dried up river wadi with the Argyles at one end of it and ourselves at the other. A very quick handover took place. We got out of our transport, the Argyles got into our transport and went back to Incheon, onto the SS Montrose and returned to Hong Kong. We were left in the wadi, and I recollect that very soon after that the Chinese appeared in the wadi, and all our equipment, which had been brought from the SS Montrose up towards us in during the past couple of days, had to be set alight by the quartermaster, because otherwise it would have fallen into Chinese hands. So we learnt what war was about very quickly as young officers in charge of our platoons. And I recollect that for the next fortnight or so, it was just a matter of withdrawing further and further south until the front was eventually stabilised and we got down to the sort of things that we had been learning to do in Hong Kong, which was to build defensive positions on the top of hills and face the Chinese assault.
Do you remember which platoon you had?
Yes, I had 12th platoon in D Company.
What kind of men did you have in that platoon?
They were all borderers from the borders of Scotland. And as I'm sure you know, this is the strength of the regimental system. They all knew each other. They came from the same towns in the borders, Melrose, Gala Shields, Selkirk, Hoyk, and Dumfries. And
Jedburgh,
absolutely. Jedburgh, Kelso, all the border towns. And they were a very fine lot of chaps. In those days, of course, a lot of them were national servicemen. A sprinkling of regular soldiers, but the majority were national servicemen. And those who had enough service left in their national service when we were in Hong Kong, of course, came with us to Korea. And they did extremely well.
So whereabouts were you when the line stabilized?
We were south of Seoul, the capital, which we had motored through on our way up to take over from the Argyles. And I do recollect that in those days, in 1950, Seoul was a town or city which had been smashed to pieces by the movement of troops back and forwards since the start of the war in June the previous year, and was just a city of rubble. And compared to what it is, of course, now, it is extraordinary. But when we went through it, it was just a pile of bricks and stone.
How did you spend the time when the line stabilised south of Seoul?
Companies had positions to occupy and hold, and we lived in trenches, which we dug, and our life consisted of patrolling out towards the Chinese front as we knew they were approaching us and discovering where they were, and defending these positions and moving forward whenever our battalion and brigade was ordered to move forward, because, as I think I've implied, the position did stabilize. And then the whole question of what the United Nations forces should do at this stage was decided by High Command. I should say that also that up until this point, the Commonwealth Division had not been formed, and we were in what was known as an United States of America Regimental Combat Team, which is equivalent to a brigade, and we were administered by the Americans, who supplied us with all our needs. But in July 1951, the Commonwealth Division was formed under Major General Castles, who was a Seaforth Highlander, and we became part of that division. At that stage, we were based in a defense position just south of the Imjin River, which, as I've said, was crossed by the Chinese on the 23rd of April, 1951, and when the well-known battle against the Gloucesters took place, just south of the Imjin River. So there we were in that position. And then it was decided that the Commonwealth Division should advance north across the Imjin River in an operation called Operation Commando. And the main feature in this operation was the taking of a hill, or yes, it was a hill, a bleak mountain, called Point 355, which we had looked at for the previous month to 6 weeks from south of the Imjin. Point 355 lay approximately 12 miles north of the Imjin River, and this was one of three objectives, but was the first objective for the Commonwealth Division to take. And in late September, we moved across the Imjin River as a battalion, and part of our brigade, which was 28th Brigade, which was one of the brigades in the Commonwealth Division, which, is, as I've explained, had been recently formed. And unknown to me, or indeed anybody else in the battalion, as we crossed the River Imjin, it fell to one KSB, my battalion, to take Point 355. And also unknown to me, it fell to D Company to take Point 355, which was a steep and difficult hill to take. And also unknown to me, it fell to 12th Platoon, which I was commanding, and 11th Platoon of D Company to actually be the assault platoons, which were ordered to go and take this hill, which we attacked on the 4th of October 1951 from the low ground due south of it, greatly supported by the Corps artillery, which was supporting this attack in Operation Commando. We were also greatly supported by the 3rd Battalion, the Royal Australian Regiment, who was one of the battalions in 28th Brigade, along with ourselves and the King Shropshire Light Infantry. And these three battalions were given the task in Operation Commando of taking Point 355, another hill called Point 317, and another feature called the Hinge. And to cut quite a long story short, one KSB took Point 355, in which I was very much concerned, and the Australians took Point 317. and also the hinge.
If possible, could you give me all the details that you remember about the taking of 355, please, as it affected you?
Yes. This was, I suppose, my first real experience of actually going to war. And 3.355 was proving a very difficult hill to take, because there were a lot of small hills due south of it and also to the east of it, in which the Chinese had placed their forward troops, very well dug in, very well camouflaged, difficult to root out. And when the battalion, my battalion, was asked to take 3.355, A, B, and C companies of the battalion were assigned to taking the low ground below 0.355, which they had considerable difficulty in doing because of not only the ground, the steepness of the slopes, but also they were covered in small trees and bushes, and they were very well camouflaged from a Chinese point of view, and the Chinese were difficult to root out. The Australians who were advancing on our right came greatly to our assistance and helped our three companies, A, B and C, to move forward into these low-lying foothills of 0.355. And by the night of the 3rd of October, this had been achieved with the great help from the 3rd Battalion, the Royal Australian Regiment. That night, the 3rd of October, my company commander, who was a very nice man, now sadly gone, Major Roddy Robertson MacLeod, was ordered by the commanding officer of my battalion, Lieutenant Colonel John MacDonald, to assault 355 on the morning of the 4th of October, 1951. We were moved forward under the hill at last light on the 3rd, of October, and lay there waiting to go into the assault at first light on the following morning. And when first light came, 0.355, this massive great hill in front of us, was reduced to absolute chaos as Corps artillery pounded the Chinese forces who were occupying the top of the feature. And I recollect that at about 9 o'clock in the morning, we were ordered forward across the start line to assault 355, which had been given the name of Little Gibraltar. Its Korean name was Kowang Sang. And so off we went, an extended line. My platoon on the left and 11 platoon on the right up this hill. Always amusing moments seem to come to mind. I remember my signaller was a chap called Marriott, Private Marriott, and halfway up this hill we were struggling up, Marriott dropped his radio set, which was my only link with gun headquarters. And there was no time to pick it up. We just went on and on up this hill with the shells from the guns landing just in front of us. And this had the effect of keeping the Chinese heads below the parapets of their trenches, and up onto the top of the hill we went. And the Chinese bugged out, I think that was the term we used to use in those days, and as we reached the top of the hill, we could see them running down the northern slopes of 0.355 into the valley below. And so by approximately 10 on the morning of the 4th, we had taken the first objective, which was Little Gibraltar, in the brigade scheme of things in Operation Commando. And during the next 2 days, the Australians, who were a magnificent battalion, went forward